down. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, I'm Ann Schindler, sitting in for Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. And just ahead, we speak with Take 'Em Down Jacks about the abrupt removal yesterday morning of the Confederate statue from the middle of the city's center, Hemming Park. Activists have been calling for the removal of the statue of a Confederate soldier for years. It was dismantled in the wee hours of Tuesday morning, shortly before the start of a scheduled protest march with Mayor Lenny Curry and Jaguars running back Leonard Fournette. We'd love to hear your calls and comments. You can reach us at 549-2937. Then later, why the need for blood donations is more urgent than ever. But this hour, on the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. Statewide, the Florida Department of Health has reported 66,000 cases of COVID-19, an increase of 1,096, and 2,765 deaths, an increase of 53. In Northeast Florida, there are now 2,809 cases and 103 deaths. Well, as we just mentioned, the city of Jacksonville removed the Confederate statue from Hemming Park early Tuesday morning. And later in the day, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry announced during an organized protest march that others in the city will be removed. Let's take a listen.
Sure, I've evolved on the importance of the issue. I've heard people. Absolutely. If our opinions and our policies don't evolve, then we're not growing and we're stagnant.
On the line now with more are Wells Todd with Take 'Em Down Jacks, Earl Johnson Jr. with Take It Down, and Monique Sampson with Jacks Community Action. With Jacks Community Action Committee. Just want to introduce you all on the show and ask you to chime in. Let's start with you, if we can, Wells Todd. What was your reaction to the news that the statue had come down in the wee hours of yesterday morning?
Well, of course, I was excited. And first of all, thanks for having me on the show. I was excited, but we have been fighting to get this statue removed now for over 4 years. And there were past efforts decades ago to get these statues removed. These statues are symbols of white supremacy, and they were put up well after the Civil War and the destruction of Reconstruction to send a message to the black community that whites were back in charge after the violent dismantling of Reconstruction. And today, what we're seeing today with people calling for justice and calling for reform of the police, started as slave patrol under the guidance of the landed aristocracy in the South. And just today, today it transformed itself from slavery to today. And what we're seeing is the nation rising up, young people rising up to deal with this institutionalized racism. But it all goes back to a time when these statues were being raised. I can give you a little history here. There were spikes in different eras, and one of the largest spikes in the raising of these statues and naming of schools came in 1909 when the NAACP was founded.
And so this statue removal surprised a lot of people, even though it's been something that people have been asking for years. And I wonder if we could hear from you, Monique, about your sense of that removal and what your feeling was about the fact that it was done prior to people being aware of that plan.
So, I mean, of course I'm excited about the removal of symbols of racism and white supremacy. My reaction was one that was joyful and happy because now students, teachers, all types of people, even citizens of Jacksonville, won't have to walk by Hemming Park and see that huge symbol of white supremacy. I also thought that, hey, why is he removing this in the middle of the night without telling people first? I thought that it was a gesture to kind of stop the momentum or attempt to stop the momentum that we have here when we're rallying against police accountability. I thought that it was a symbolic gesture in order for him to escape enacting progressive legislation and progressive reform to address the problem that we have here with policing. So you can take down symbols of white supremacy, but when it's embedded in your structure and the system of Jacksonville, we've got a lot more work to do.
And so, Monique, you have you take issue with the fact that the statue was removed without sort of giving the community a moment around that or an opportunity to weigh in?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, if you're going to remove all of them, if you're going to remove one of them, you should definitely remove all of them. So you should remove that huge statue that's in Confederate Park overnight as well. They should have all been removed at the same time. And a notice would have been nice to give to the activists that have been pressuring him for years to get this removed. And he's given us multiple excuses saying that we had to go through city council, we had to get petitions signed, when all along he could have removed them overnight. So it just seems like all of that work, he just lied in our face. So yes, that's how I feel about them removing it overnight without telling groups first, or at least mentioning it, you know?
And Mr. Johnson, I wonder if you feel that he was doing that perhaps to avoid some of the controversy that removing these statues has generated in the past. It's been a pretty hot discussion over the years.
Well, that's true. Hello, Earl Johnson Jr. of TakeItDown.org. And that may have been the case, but it flashed a sense of arrogance, frankly. It is one step to remove the monument from the hallowed grounds of Hemming Plaza, the location of the 1960 axe handle Saturday, where a white mob carrying axe handles savagely beat black young school children who were protesting for their rights at Woolworth. And so to have that symbol of white supremacy on those hallowed grounds was just a slap in the face. I can tell you that was one small yet belated step in the right direction. Jacksonville, now that Richmond has decided to take its Monument Avenue down, Jacksonville leads the world in Confederate monuments, memorials, tributes, structures, school names, parks, leads the world. Go to visitjax.com. If you Google Confederate and Jax, your city website comes up to show you all the wonderful treasonous Confederate sites we have. You may ask yourself in this country, why is it that the traitors got all of these statues? They are scattered all over the country. And our organization, I believe it to be the first. And granted, we are a young organization, but I can tell you that we've struck a chord. The work that Todd and this group have been doing here, we're taking it nationally. The NRA is inextricably involved in the preservation of these locations. The current NRA president is also the president of the country's largest memorial, Confederate Memorial Society. The KKK built many of these during Jim Crow. There was a clear connection between KKK and white supremacy during that time. You'll notice they didn't come up during Reconstruction when blacks, you know, after the end of the enslavement of black Americans, we as black people rushed into the American dream wholeheartedly. Store owners, business owners, politicians, a voting electorate, all happening during Reconstruction. So there was no way that these white supremacists were going to get these statues up and these memorials up during that time. It was at the end of Reconstruction that the traitors got their way. I am still looking for Benedict Arnold's statue, have not found it yet. So a step in the right direction. We have a long, long way to go. Our four-day organization has hundreds of members across the country already. GoDaddy has our website rating at 91% in the last 4 days. And so we struck a chord. There are not only black Americans, but white Americans and all Americans of goodwill who want to see these things come down. And by the way, we have spent, as Americans, $40 million, according to the Smithsonian, $40 million in just the last several years on preservation of these vestiges of hate.
Well, we're getting a lot of comments on our Facebook page. A comment from Lisa, I think the statues should be placed in a historical museum. A plaque could then be placed where it originally stood that would direct others to its new location. A comment from Linnell, why did you announce the abrupt removal of the statue from Hemming? It was delayed, very delayed. And then another comment from Gary saying, my question is, why did they do it in the dark of night? Was the mayor worried of backlash or protest? We're getting a number of calls, too. I'd like to go to Keith in Riverside, if I could. Good morning, Keith. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. Interesting discussion. I don't want anybody to be fooled by what the mayor is doing. The only reason these statues came down is because he did not want the spectacle of the Republican convention being held here and people rallying around those monuments and that being flashed all around the world. He doesn't give a damn what we think. This is all about PR for him and the Republican administration. He doesn't care what you think. This is all about public relations and embarrassing the city.
Mm-hmm, because it could be a flashpoint. Thank you, Keith. I appreciate that. Monique, I wonder if you could respond to that.
Yes, definitely respond to that for sure. So one of the things that like we're noticing is like we have the same idea as well. We have the Republican National Convention coming. You know, he wants to take down the statues to prepare for that. It was a very odd decision to make because, one, you're taking down racist statues, but you're willing to host one of the most racist presidents in our time. So again, with the symbolic gestures, symbolic gestures mean nothing if there's not action placed behind those gestures.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I heard yesterday when I was at the protest from some of the protesters was the sentiment that if the mayor had not made the decision to take them down, that it would have been taken down one way or another by activists. I wonder what your thoughts are about that. Obviously, that's something that's been happening globally and around the country.
I think that social movements all around the world and all around the country may have inspired some people to take down symbols of white supremacy here in the city. I mean, we've had monuments that have been defaced by people that we don't know. And I think that people would have seen, you know, Christopher Columbus's head being beheaded in Boston, or former slave traders and slave owners being taken down and thrown in the river. And maybe people here would have gotten ideas. So maybe you're right. They would have been taken down either way. And maybe the mayor thought that this was the best way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Johnson, I wonder if you think that this was a trade-off of sorts that the mayor was making, kind of what the caller from Riverside, Keith, was suggesting, in advance of the RNC, which is looking likelier than ever.
Excuse me?
I just wonder if you think that there was some sort of trade-off there in terms of making the RNC more palatable to people by making a gesture of inclusiveness or removing the statue.
Well, you know, notwithstanding the Washington Post's reporting this morning that the RNC is coming, those of us who were paying attention saw that the RNC had bought up all of the hotel rooms in Jacksonville last week. So the timing is suspect.
Hmm. Interesting.
Can I say something?
Yes, certainly.
I think that what we're seeing here is politically motivated to try and win over Florida. I think that's one of the reasons Trump relocated to Florida. But what we're also seeing is Florida is the epicenter now of white supremacy. And this city right here is the headquarters. I have to say that. Mm-hmm. And this is the battle that's going to go down to preserve white supremacy and institutionalize racism. I want to go back to what Mr. Johnson said about Axe Handle Saturday. Axe Handle Saturday was where the Klan and other white supremacist groups got together and came downtown and beat any black person that they saw. And in fact, the police had been notified that it was going to happen by an informant who was in the KKK. And they did nothing. They did nothing until black people started to fight back, and then they started to arrest black people. And I want to bring this back to what the police really stand for in this country, because people need to understand why reform is so hard to do. The police department in this country morphed from slave patrol into police who carried out black codes that were written by rich landowners in this country to put black people back in jail, put them in jail, put them back on a plantation, force them into sharecropping, force them into a peonage system, and the police have been doing that ever since. The police are an issue, and they are not being held accountable for their actions, and we have to understand why. And we have to get to the heart and the root of white supremacy and institutionalized racism mm-hmm. as it exists in the police department today across this country.
I want to make sure that we're getting some voices from our callers here, too. If I could just really quick introduce John. He's calling from the north side. John, go ahead.
Hello, Ann. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, okay, great. And good morning to your guests. No, I just wanted to weigh in. You know, with Hemming, you have to remember it was Hemming Plaza. Then it was changed to Hemming Park. And then not only that, but it used to be under, it was a, the city had control, but then it was given to the not-for-profits. And we had that Vince, the Friends of Hemming Park, and you had that Vince Cavan who ran it, then Christina Parrish that ran it. And so going forward, you know, we're giving all these different parks to these not-for-profits. So as far as this particular issue, I don't know who the current executive director is with the Friends of Hemming Park, but I would wonder if the conversation has been going that way as to, you know, the city doesn't have as much control as the not-for-profits that have been given these parks. Unity Plaza is another one at 220 Riverside as an example, where that was a $2 million public park given to a not-for-profit. And then $750,000 to run it, which now it's, you know, it no longer exists. So going forward, like Confederate Park right now, is, you know, what is the status of that? But the big thing is, you know, with all these monuments, I don't know where all of them are, if they're all in parks. But I think that should be one of the areas to explore going forward as to, you know, how that works.
Thanks for those comments. Appreciate it. Getting some comments, too, on our Facebook page. One is saying, what should the park be named? Go back to St. James Park. Jim saying, you can't change history. It is what it is. You learn from history, and removing them didn't change a thing. I think it was the wrong thing to do. Just now, we live with this time in history and should try to learn from it. A comment from Siobhan. I want to know when we are going to start listening to Black people the first time they raise issues. They have consistently been ignored and maligned in this city to our detriment. And now, on the anniversary of Axe Handle Saturday, our mayor has petitioned the RNC to bring the convention to Jacksonville, a literal gut punch for this city. I believe we've got still Wells on the line. Could you comment on that? Are you? What are your thoughts about the what going forward we might see in terms of name changes?
Well, I mean, there are many names that the African-American community could come up with, and that's something that could be decided down the line. But I want to address the caller who said we were trying to erase history, because this has cropped up many, many times. We are not trying to erase history. We are trying to correct history. It was the landowners, the rich Southern landowners, who rewrote Southern history. They rewrote the narrative, okay, and created a narrative of racial hatred against Black people. They left out Black people in the history of the South. They told people that the war was not fought to perpetuate slavery, which was a lie. So what I'm saying to people who believe we want to erase history, no. We want to correct history, and we want history to be corrected in our schools. We need our kids to understand what white supremacy is and institutionalized racism, and until they do, the schools will continue to put out white supremacists. They will continue to create white people who believe they built and ran and run this country, and that Black people are inferior.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there's a number of schools in this city with names of Confederate generals. Until very recently, there was a school on the West Side named after a member of the KKK. So there is not just what's being taught in schools, but what is the name of a school that I think some people take issue with. Isn't that right?
Exactly. Exactly. And we were in the forefront of getting Nathan Bedford Forrest High School renamed. He was the first Grand Wizard of the KKK and was a slave catcher and a slave seller, and killed 300 people, gave the order to kill 300 people at Fort Pillow, And the Daughters of the Confederacy came in and said, after Brown versus Board of Education, said, no, we're going to name this school after Nathan Bedford Forrest, a murderer.
Mm-hmm. Monique, I wonder what your thoughts are about what names should be removed or changed. What, in terms of, you know, there's a number of sites around the city, for instance, you know, the Hart Bridge, even some people have taken issue with. What would you like to see in terms of renaming or repurposing of some of those monuments?
Mm-hmm.
Are you there, Monique?
Yes, I'm here. So I guess my viewpoint on what the name should be changed to, since there are so many sites, is since these schools are located in predominantly Black neighborhoods, we have a bunch of legends, Black legends here in Jacksonville, Black civil rights legends that these schools could be named after. They could name the schools after the proximity in which the schools are at as well. So we have no shortage of names that can honor history. And I definitely agree with what Wells said about we're not taking history away. We're correcting it. We're staring a dead narrative, an incorrect narrative, a false narrative in the face and saying, this is not okay. This is simply not okay. So in regards to changing these names, we have a bunch of wonderful names that we can choose from, especially for our schools, especially for our monuments, and especially for our, we can take the statues down and change the names of the parks. So it definitely is possible.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Johnson, I wonder what your thoughts are about next steps. I mean, the mayor said that there will be additional, that, you know, the Confederate statues will come down. I don't know that that includes Andrew Jackson, which is, you know, outside where the old landing was, has been a target of vandalism in the past and is considered somewhat a symbol as well of Confederate era history. You there, Mr. Johnson?
Oh, I am. Hello. I didn't know you were referring to me. And I, yes, hi. Thank you very much. Obviously, Andrew Jackson was not a Confederate. He was a homicidal killer of thousands and thousands and thousands of indigenous Americans, though. And we'll have to ask ourselves whether That's the statue that we want to represent our city. I can tell you this. Jacksonville has a reputation problem amongst Black Americans. Ask your Black friends anywhere in the country, and they will tell you that Jacksonville has a reputation of being one of the most racist cities in the country. And that's unfortunate for me as a third-generation native of Jacksonville, and as someone who sat at the dinner table with Martin Luther King's attorney, my father, who desegregated every school in Florida and every park in Florida. And he and Mom talked about big issues and referred to Dr. King as Martin and Ambassador Young as Andy. Talked about big issues, big changes, and taking big risks. This problem at Jacksonville is all over our country. States that were not in existence at the time of the Civil War, states that were a part of America, the American Union, at the time of the Civil War, all have these Confederate structures, these monuments to racism. It's time to defund racism. It's time we finally, once and for all, get the Confederacy off government welfare,
mm-hmm.
off our dime.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am focused specifically on Confederate homages, monuments, public land in this country.
A couple of more Facebook comments here. One from Hope. Here's the mayor's press conference in March yesterday was a sham, a photo op where he could co-opt the movement and build up a stash of images and false cohesion between protesters, the police, and government. The JAG certainly played a role, and their voices are appreciated, but the NFL is one of the few things Curry cares about. I wonder, Wells Todd, if you could chime in on that. What are your thoughts about whether that march yesterday was meaningful or more of a opportunity to show unity in the city?
Well, I want to agree with Hope wholeheartedly on that. What you saw yesterday, what people saw yesterday, I don't know if it was more than 100 people, but what that march was, was a counter protest against Curry and the sheriff. They were marching to demand change behind them because Curry and the police here, they didn't talk about any change at that press conference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They didn't talk about any change at all. They talked about forming a committee to investigate the needs of the committee. Well, community. Well, that was done in 1968. It was done in the 30s. It was done in the 20s. And they know exactly what needs to be done to correct the poverty and the abuse by the police here in the city. They know what needs to be done, but they won't address it.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that yesterday, to me, was an insult to the black community and to the white community of Jacksonville. And bringing this convention here, it's a terrible idea for the city.
Mm-hmm.
Because as this movement grows, and it is a movement, this city could be in a lot of trouble. And I, for one, will participate in trying to keep it from coming here. A lot of people will get hurt. People will be coming in here from other cities and states. And I think we need to confront and continue to address the white supremacist fascist that is sitting in the White House, who keeps attacking and dividing the races in this country. And we must push forward to continue to build this movement. As a matter of fact, Saturday, there will be another rally outside the courthouse starting at 3 o'clock to continue to push for our demand.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. We appreciate all of you this morning. Wells Todd with Take 'Em Down Jacks, Earl Johnson Jr. with Take It Down, and Monique Sampson with Jack's Community Action Committee. We thank all of you for being a part of this conversation this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. You guys have a good day. Much more still ahead later on. Operation New Hope is helping to provide face masks for inmates and prison officers. But next, why the need for blood donation is more critical than ever. We'll be right back.
Voidcast from WJCT is a musical journey through Northeast Florida. I'm the host, Void Magazine editor Matt Shaw. Join me while I cut through the digital noise to share handpicked local music stories. WJCT.org/Voidcast.
Electro Lounge can now be heard Monday through Fridays at 10 p.m. till midnight and Saturdays from 9 to 11. Join us at the Electro Lounge only on 89.9 WJCT.
Introducing the Jacksonville Music Experience from WJCT, offering music lovers a variety of ways to enjoy favorite artists and discover new genres. Download the WJCT app or visit wjct.org/jacksmusic to start listening today.
Welcome back. World Blood Donor Day is coming up this Saturday, and right now the need for blood donations is more critical than ever. Last week, Melissa Ross spoke with Karen Patterson, Community Development Coordinator for Life South.
Karen Patterson, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Melissa.
Now, World Blood Donor Day is coming up on June 14th, and you are fully operational and have been throughout this pandemic to make sure that local hospitals have a stable blood supply. Tell us how the pandemic has been affecting your operations.
Well, as an essential service, we've remained totally open throughout everything, and we're so thankful for our partners in the community and the other members that come over and donate with us and help share local lives. Right now, we're kind of in a little bit of a challenging spot because blood donations are really needed right now. Hospitals have resumed surgeries. There's more cars on the road, which equals more accidents. And then we also have patients that need continuing care, such as those who are facing cancer.
Sure. So you're still encouraging people to donate blood and not be afraid to do so, right?
Absolutely. We have really enhanced our sanitation protocols. We're establishing social distancing on our blood mobiles and also taking donors' temperatures before they actually get on the blood mobile, just for an extra layer of safety.
One thing that might motivate people to donate, too, is that you have antibody testing for COVID-19 for all blood donors. How does that work?
Absolutely, yes. We have started doing COVID testing on all of our potential donors. So whenever somebody donates and they find out if they did have those antibodies, we're collecting convalescent plasma to help those who are still battling the disease recover. So it's something really exciting we've just started doing, and we really encourage everyone to come out and take advantage of it.
Okay, and so if someone tests positive, they have COVID antibodies in their system, they can donate plasma. That has really become a critical tool for doctors to treat patients with COVID. So that's also helping healthcare workers right now.
Absolutely. And it's a really quick turnaround time. If you come in and donate convalescent plasma, that is going to be going to a patient within 48 hours. So we're really expediting the process and really getting a lot of it. We're currently looking for more convalescent plasma donors. So that's our hope, that if you get tested and you do have the antibodies, which indicates some immunity, you can really quickly turn around and help someone currently battling it.
All right. And we're heading into the summer months. Hospitals have started resuming elective surgeries, too. So this is a critical time, even more so than usual, for people to do their part and donate blood.
Absolutely. And right now we do have the trifecta coming with hurricane season just starting. So, and a lot of people don't realize the time that you need to have the blood on the shelves is before a disaster happens. So we encourage people to consider it part of their hurricane preparedness plan. You know, after you get your batteries and you store up on gas and water, consider coming out and donating blood to help those people that might be affected.
It's, you know, it's easy to donate blood. It doesn't take a lot of time. You're in and out, and you've really done your part to help your fellow man. Now, people can go to your website, lifesouth.org, but you're also encouraging people to maybe host a blood drive. How can they do that?
Absolutely. We work with businesses of all sizes. So if you are a business owner or you belong to a church or a local organization, we would love to come out and work with you and save some lives here on the First Coast.
So get in touch with them, LifeSouth. Go to lifesouth.org. Karen Patterson, she's LifeSouth's District Community Development Coordinator. Thanks so much, Karen. And again, World Blood Donor Day is coming up on the 14th, so donate some blood. Thanks so much, Karen.
You're welcome. And really quick, if I can just mention, we are doing something special for World Blood Donor Day. If you come to our centers on June 12th, you're going to get a special rescue team T-shirt, your COVID-19 antibody testing, and also a $10 gift card.
So there you go. A little added incentive.
Yes, ma'am.
Naomi Chase works for the Jacksonville Public Library and helped implement the city's mortgage rent and utility relief grant program. She wrote about her experience for last Sunday's Florida Times Union, and she joins us now with more. Naomi, good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. Your essay was really a heartrending look at people in need in this crisis, economic crisis and health crisis. What prompted you to write this story?
Well, initially, I was so grateful to have something to do, you know, something constructive, productive to do. And I was really proud of the library, of the director, Tim Rogers, who rallied us all so quickly to answer the call. I was happy to be doing it, and glad that it was benefiting others, it quickly became actually quite emotionally grueling because the reality was so hard to ignore. The need is fantastic, and, you know, it's going to continue to be.
So tell us a little bit about, for people who may not have seen the piece that you wrote, a little bit about what you were doing and who you were, the kind of conversations you were having with people.
Right. So we had, there were 36 tables set up in the main library. There was a second location at the Jesse Ball building too. Not Jesse Ball. Anyway, we would hold up a sign saying next, and there were long lines of people who would enter the auditorium first, and then they would proceed, standing 6 feet apart, of course. And as we hosted each customer at our table, also sitting 6 feet apart, we had a file, and there was a procedure for seeing their photo ID and then their documentable income. So we basically were determining that they met the criteria, the requirements.
Of course, this was for the city grant program that was designed to help people who were in need of rent or utility, you know, bills that were coming due.
Right, and it was in the form of a debit card for $1,000.
Mm-hmm. And so your job was to vet whether they met the economic requirements, but you also heard a lot of their personal stories. Is that right?
Right.
So talk a little bit about what that was like, hearing those stories for you and for them.
So I'm going to read from the essay because I think it's really...
Please
can,
do.
Can I do?
Sure.
Is that okay?
Certainly.
Okay. Here's a real real time. I wrote it in the first person as though it were happening that moment. She sits 6 feet away from me at a table at the main library. For 12 minutes, I invade her privacy, demand documentation of her suffering, and try to approve her for the COVID-19 Mortgage Rent and Utility Relief Grant, otherwise known as the MRU. She is one of thousands applying for the $1,000 debit card. She pants as she navigates the app on her phone that records her direct deposits from her employer. She must prove she was working on February 29, 2020. That's the date that ascertains her income loss to be directly due to COVID-19. I need this information on paper to put in her file. I didn't know I had to provide a document, she says, crying. Her hands shake. I'm not supposed to touch her phone. I lean in, try to talk to her, walk her through the steps. A monitor reminds me to keep social distance. I raise my pink IT flag for a technical assistant. He approaches and says to the woman, "You're all right. It's fine. It's fine." He cannot pat her on the shoulder. He assesses the app, finds the necessary information, and tells her how to send it to me in an email. I look at him gratefully and say, "These flags should be white for surrender. You are the new first responder. You're literally rescuing people." Hmm. He looks surprised, humbled by my praise. The woman is only slightly more all right than when she first sat down at my table. I have met hundreds like her in the 3 weeks since the program began. COVID-19 is not the invisible enemy. It's right here in front of me, every day, all day, in the faces of Duval residents whose lives stopped when the city shut down.
Very evocative writing there, Naomi. And I wonder if your thoughts are... that you were also being in that position of a first responder. I mean, that you're receiving some of this anxiety and this grief that people are feeling in such a difficult time.
Right. I was really proud to live in a city that is making this available. It was a procedure that was assembled, I think, in record time. And we learned as we went along that there were some deficiencies, there were some technical problems. That were quickly resolved. By the fourth week we were doing it, it was pretty streamlined. But it had hazards. You know, you were invading people's privacy. You were looking at their bank statements, and not to mention the health risks of being in interactions with that many people in the public.
People mostly grateful when they're dealing with you, or their anxieties that caused them to have, was it difficult sometimes to deal with their anxiety?
Yeah, well, that made for an interesting study in itself. Most of our customers were deeply grateful. There were some other interesting observations as we went through this. So many people had never been to the library downtown. They'd never been to the main library, or hadn't been in quite some time. I ended every encounter with a recommendation that people tried to, if they didn't already have library cards, to get e-cards so that they could access this library's pretty comprehensive digital collection. And they had, so many of them had no idea that that was even available. The other observations were that, you know, if I asked people, you know, have you been sick? Do you know anyone who's been sick? And they didn't really care. They were very in the moment of this terrible need. And it made their pain very real for me. It's not invisible.
Well, Naomi Chase with the Jacksonville Public Library, we're so glad to have you on this morning. Thank you for sharing your story in the Florida Times Union. And thanks again for your comments today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Have a good day. Now we're going to bring on station manager David Luckin. He's going to tell us a little bit about the current pledge drive.
Thanks, Ann. 353-9528. We're just going to take about a minute and a half out of this program to get you to the phones because WJCT is here for you with vital coverage during complex times that we are living in today. Your support keeps WJCT strong and keeps us bringing you news. First Coast Connect, all of our great programs, local and national and international. Costs us a good deal of money to bring you all the programs, so we ask you just a couple times a year to help us out at 353-9528, 1-800-722-9528, or anytime at all online at wjct.org. Excellent program today, as it always is. We are here every morning bringing you the current news that you need to know more about, and we bring on the guests and the newsmakers in the community, and you get a chance to actually ask them questions. It's kind of an open mic every morning here for the community to get to talk to the important newsmakers and to better understand what's going on in our community. WJCT is here to keep you and this community always informed, and the station delivers exactly what you expect every single day. We have reporters covering our whole community every day, bringing you what's important. But it's not possible without financial support from listeners just like you. That's what makes it all possible. So take the time now to go online at wjct.org/radio or give us a call at 353-9528. If you're outside the local calling area, of course, you can call us at 904-722-9528. And remember, every dollar you donate is being matched. So think about that when you donate that $5, $500, $50, $120, whatever amount, it will be double thanks to our First Coast Society. So take time, take a break, give us a call, 353-9528. Use your Visa, MasterCard, American Express, or Discover, and set up a sustainer account, and then you won't even know. $10 a month just comes out of your account, goes right into programming, and we will continue to bring you great programming. It's all made possible because of listeners just like you. So why don't you take the time now to give us a call at 1-800-722-9528, or you can text GIVE 899-244-321. And of course, you can give online, or you can just make a check payable to WJCT. Send it to 100 Festival Park Avenue, Jacksonville, Florida, 32202. And that will help us out too. So in any way you want to help us at any amount is good. We've got a few thank you gifts. We've got a great JME, Jacksonville Music Experience t-shirt. We've got a beautiful big beach towel that our volunteers will tell you about. And of course, at the $120 level, $10 a month, we have two masks for you to keep you healthy and your family healthy. Take the time now, and we will go back to First Coast Connect in just a minute or so. You've still got time to call us as a community grapples with all these developing events every day. We are here to help explain them to you. 353-9528 or 1-800-722-9528. And thank you.
Congaree and Penn, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering picnic meals in a safe, dog-friendly farm setting where social distancing is top priority. Visit congareeandpen.com for more information. One Florida Clinical Research Consortium invites essential workers in healthcare to join the HERO Registry and share how the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted their lives with researchers from the University of Florida and nationwide. Clinical and non-clinical personnel can register online to tell their story at heroesresearch.org, because the best way to thank healthcare heroes is to learn from them. Woodcraft offers Father's Day gift certificates for woodworking tools, supplies, and classes for new and experienced woodworkers. Locally owned since 2003, Woodcraft is located in St. John's Plaza at Beach Boulevard and St. John's Bluff. Woodcraft, helping you make woodwork.
Rather than holding up a Bible, America's faith leaders are urging the president to spend more time reading it. As people raise up their voices, so too have Christian, Jewish, and Muslim luminaries. We'll hear why so many now see their response to this moment as much political as it is spiritual, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT is here to keep you and this community informed as the station delivers exactly what you expect when you need it most. Remember that it's financial support from listeners like you that make it possible. Support WJCT today at wjct.org/radio or call us at 353-9528.
And welcome back. Operation New Hope is working with the Florida Department of Corrections and the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition to deliver masks both to prison inmates and to officers. Linda Joseph is Operation New Hope's COO, and Corvus Whitaker, the organization's Ready for Release manager, are on the line right now. Corvus, I wonder if we could start with you. Tell us a little bit about the program that you had last week to bring some of these masks to prisoners and the guards. Corvus, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well, and yourself?
Very good, thank you. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the mask delivery that you helped participate in last week in Lake Butler.
Yes. So what it was, Kevin Gay, our president, he actually got a message from Mr. Desmond Mead, which I'm sure you guys are aware of. And through that process, I coordinated with Baker Correctional, and he ran it up to the Region 2 director, and that came down, and they gave us approval to take the mask up there and hand-deliver them to those guys at Lake Butler. And I want to say it was roughly 10 or 12,000 masks that was delivered, so it was a pretty big deal.
Mm-hmm. And Linda Joseph, what was the goal with this? What was the need that you all were responding to deliver masks to prisons?
Good morning. We actually see our partners at the Florida Department of Corrections as on the front lines, just like healthcare workers and doctors and, emergency responders. They're in situations where there is a lot of close proximity and they're not able to do the physical distancing like other organizations are. And they needed more resources. The prison in Lake Butler has an entire medical facility. And so we were able to support not only the nurses with some medical grade masks, but also the inmates and the staff. And we're happy to have that partnership with DOC.
You talk a little bit about the need, Linda. I'm sure you're hearing from family members of prisoners about concerns. I know that we've been hearing about them in news, concerns that there aren't proper protections, that there aren't, that there isn't possible, it's impossible to social distance. Well, what concerns are you hearing from people that you work with?
I think that the Florida Department of Corrections has done the probably the best that they can to try to cope with this. Corvus and I were actually just at Baker Prison this week, and they've had zero cases from inmates or staff. So I think it's the ability to react quickly, just like hospitals and nursing homes have done on the outside. And they have separated inmates that are potentially sick. They have released some inmates that are low violent offenders to try to help make sure that they can curb the curve also within the prisons. But I think that they're doing the best that they can with the resources that they can.
Mm-hmm. And Corvus, Operation New Hope enrolls approximately 450 clients in that Ready for Work program each year. What do you do with your clients? How do you help them adjust when they are released?
So we are the Ready for Release team, as you stated earlier. So the good thing about that is once you're enrolled into the Ready for Release program, you get that immediate support, or you get immediate access to our program. And one of the biggest things is you get secure housing, which, you know, a lot of inmates coming out, they don't have housing or support, so we are able to provide those things before you get released.
Mm-hmm. And Linda, what is it about having a stability on the outside? I mean, I would guess that there's some value to the people being released, but also to the larger community.
Yeah, this is all about providing second chances and making our community safer. They've paid their dues, they've done their time, and now it's time to kind of get rid of the scarlet letter and give them an opportunity to get a job and reintegrate back into the community. And by making that a successful transition, it increases public safety, and it's just overall good. Employers end up with high-quality employees, and folks get a second chance at having a different type of lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Right now, people are looking for some concrete ways to dismantle systemic racism. I wonder what Operation New Hope is doing on that front in terms of criminal justice reform.
You know, we've been at the forefront of criminal justice reform, and Kevin even reminded us that, you know, our roots 20 years ago was helping with affordable housing in parts of Jacksonville where, we could help people of color. This is a big topic. It's a topic for us, and we believe that criminal justice reform is kind of at the heart of how we do this. So, unfortunately, we're catching folks at the back end, but we want to make sure that we use our political capital and influence to try to change things further upstream in the criminal justice world.
Mm-hmm. And what changes would be helpful? What would you like to see?
We think that there's three parts to it. There's sentencing reform, so looking at how people are sentenced and making sure that it's equitable across all races. The second one is prison reform. So what happens when you're actually incarcerated? Yeah, how are we using this time to actually rehabilitate and provide GEDs and provide job training and psychological help and substance abuse help? And the third one is reentry reform, which is kind of what we're most known for. Once you get out, what are we doing to make sure that there's a fair and level playing field for everybody that gets out?
Mm-hmm. Well, Linda Joseph from Operation New Hope and Corvus Whitaker from that group's Ready for Release program, very happy to have you this morning. Thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Well, that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Have questions or comments about First Coast Connect? Send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Ann Schindler, sitting in for Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow, but if you missed anything, you can listen to the replay at 8 p.m. or find today's show at wjct.org and on your favorite podcast platform. Let's connect again.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.